From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, what happened in two Detroit area hospitals during the COVID-19 surge?
They came up with a way to split one oxygen tank among two patients. So they shared the oxygen among them, even though they didn't know whether those patients had coronavirus or not.
Four nurses file suit against their employer for understaffing and gear shortages. Also, what one activist means when she says defund the police.
Why can't city leaders and police sit down and come up with viable solutions from city leaders, from residents, and find out how we can allocate some of that $54 million back in the community for education, back in the community for job opportunities.
And author Sharon Harrigan on taking readers to traumatic places with her new novel, Half.
I hope that in the end it feels cathartic to readers to go to those deep places and come out the other end.
Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. At protests across the United States and here in Michigan, you've heard a familiar refrain, defund the police. Today on the show, we speak with a community activist in Grand Rapids about what that means. But first, four nurses have filed a lawsuit against Tenet Healthcare, the parent company of DMC and Sinai Grace, in a whistleblower lawsuit over what they say was negligence and mismanagement that led to unnecessary deaths and conditions amid the COVID-19 surge. Kristen Jordan-Shamus is a reporter with the Detroit Free Press who's been writing about this. Kristen, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks, April.
Before we dive in, I want to play a little piece of audio from one of the nurses that you talked to for your story, Catherine Goggin. And she works at Sinai Grace. And she gave this really harrowing story in your article and also during a press conference that happened a day later. Let's listen.
Yeah, we had a young man, he was in his late 30s, early 40s, come into the recess room, which is where we see critical patients that need to be seen right away. He could not breathe. So they decided to go ahead and intubate him. I was his nurse in that room. I moved him over to TCU, which is our transitional care unit. And while he was over there, I guess, come to find out that his ventilator tubing that was connected to the tube had come disconnected. And we were so short-staffed, nobody realized it. This was an old ventilator that the respiratory therapist didn't know how to use to begin with. And he ended up dying because it came disconnected from his tube. I mean, I will always remember this man because I heard the doctor calling his daughter and saying, "I'm sorry to inform you that your father has passed away." And I remember like stopping him and saying, "Wait, the guy that was in two that we took over to TCU 10? And he goes, "Yeah, Kat, he died." And I was like, "What?" Like, I was like baffled. That man should have never died. So then I went over to TCU to figure out what happened. And that's what happened. His tube came disconnected. So he basically suffocated to death in that room.
Again, that's nurse Catherine Goggin describing conditions at work at Sinai Grace. We're talking with Kristen Jordan-Shamus, the reporter at the Detroit Free Press who wrote about the story. Kristen, I mean, it's just heartbreaking and kind of unbelievable. But aside from this anecdote that Catherine Goggin just gave us, what else are the nurses saying happened?
Their stories are pretty devastating. And they talked about how at some points during the peak of the pandemic, they ran out of stretchers and beds. Some of the patients just had to sit in chairs until a bed opened up, and some of them died there. They talked about how they got so low on ventilators, some of them were hooked up to machines that were so old, the respiratory therapists weren't completely sure how to use them. They ran out of monitors that they used to track a patient's vital signs. So they would have patients lined up in the hallway so they could keep a better eye on them to make sure that they were still getting enough air. They talked about how they went down to just one body bag and they prayed that nobody else would die that day because they didn't know what they'd do if they ran out of body bags. And then they described what they did when they ran out of oxygen tanks. So they came up with a way to split one oxygen tank among two patients. So they shared the oxygen among them, even though they didn't know whether those patients had coronavirus or not, which meant that they could be infecting one another.
I mean, it just sounds like war zone conditions, not a major metropolitan hospital. Has the hospital made any response to the nurses' claims yet?
the DMC, the Detroit Medical Center, which owns and operates Sinai Grace, has said that they can't comment on pending litigation. But in late April, after CNN aired photos of body bags stacked inside a sleep study lab at the hospital, and around that time, night shift nurses had also staged a protest because they said they were so short-staffed, the situation was unsafe for patients. And right around then, I also interviewed the CEO of the DMC. Her name is Audrey Gregory. And she told me that what the nurses were reporting wasn't necessarily the reality that existed. But she also said she didn't want to get into a back and forth with the nurses or negate their feelings. And she said that they did bring in extra staff to try to reinforce the ranks at the emergency department within Sinai Grace. But the nurses that I interviewed said that that extra help came way too late and well after the crisis was over.
What's happened to these four nurses since they started speaking out about the conditions during the surge?
Well, a couple of them have found new jobs. Catherine Goggin, the woman who just spoke, told me that she's in therapy now and she suffers from PTSD after what she experienced. But one of the nurses, Sal Hadwan, he told me he's not ready to look for work again. It's overwhelming for him to think about what it would be like to work in an emergency room if there were a second wave of the virus and another surge. He doesn't know if he could handle it.
Have any other hospital staff come forward to either confirm or tell some different stories since the lawsuit was filed?
I have not interviewed any, but from what I understand, a couple of other employees at Sinai Grace are also considering legal action. And then there was one nurse, her name is Kenisa Barkai, and she's from Woodhaven, and she sued the DMC before this group of four nurses did.
What do you think is at stake here for the hospital system, depending on how this suit is handled and comes out?
Yeah, it's a real challenge because Sinai Grace is a safety net hospital, and it provides care in a part of the city where there aren't other hospitals and where there are a lot of people who don't have regular access to healthcare and can't afford it. So the doctors and nurses there, they're all committed to helping the community and working in the city. And it definitely affects the reputation of that hospital and those who continue to work there. And the fear is that people who live in the area and need Sinai Grace for medical care, that they'll be less willing to turn to the hospital when they need medical help.
Mm-hmm. When you look at the conditions that were pretty prevalent in Michigan in March and April, and you think about the entirety of what was happening during the COVID surge, the kind of overwhelm that they're describing, do you see it as being avoidable or preventable, or is the hospital the appropriate place to look when we talk about who was really responsible for this? Was there anything that the hospital might have done differently?
You know, I think a lot of people, a lot of within the medical community, there was a lot of surprise, I think, at how quickly coronavirus ramped up and how quickly we went from no cases at all to being in the middle of a really awful surge. And, you know, when I did interviews in February, before we had any cases in Michigan, a lot of the health systems and directors I spoke with all said, yes, we're prepared. We're ready. We've got this. You know, we have a plan in place. We have a system. We're ready. But I don't know if you can ever be ready for what we experienced. I don't know if anyone can ever say, unless you've experienced it and you know exactly what's coming at you, it's hard to prepare for that. And the question is just whether they could have brought in more help more quickly, whether we could have gotten supplies faster. But those supplies were all in demand all across the country, not just in Michigan. So I don't really know the answer to that question.
Did the nurses say anything about bringing up their concerns at the time all this was happening?
They were very concerned, and they complained to the administration and to management about some of the situations that they were facing. One of the policies that came down, they said, at the height of the pandemic was that they weren't allowed to perform CPR on patients who were suspected of having COVID-19. So if a patient came in and they thought that person had COVID-19, at the time there were no rapid tests available, They were told they had to just let that person die, that they could not perform CPR because the risk was too high to the nurses and the doctors and the staff in terms of contracting the disease. They felt like that was really wrong.
This is such a conundrum. I know that there are some healthcare professionals who went into work being concerned, you know, wanting to make good on all their responsibilities, but wanting to, you know, having their own concerns about whether they would be safe if they did such a thing. In this case, it sounds like they're saying that their administrators told them under no circumstances should they put themselves at risk that way.
Right. And there was one nurse who told a story, and it didn't actually make my story in the Free Press, but it was one that stuck with me and still kind of haunts me a little bit. And it's the story of a man in his 30s who came in, and he had been passing out. He'd been having fainting spells. And he also had a little bit of trouble breathing, but he didn't have a fever. And so they didn't initially classify him as a COVID-19 case. And he waited for almost 24 hours before he got any care. And he was at a sink washing up, and he said that the man fainted again. He passed out. But this time, it appeared that he was going into some sort of, you know, horrible shock, and he needed CPR. And so they rushed over, they performed CPR on him. They started running tests, they put him on a ventilator, and they discovered that he had a huge pulmonary embolism, a big blood clot. And then they started to connect the dots. People who were younger, who had coronavirus, were beginning to show up at emergency rooms with strokes and with blood clots. And so that then classified him as a COVID-19 patient. And so when he coded again, when he needed to be revived again, they weren't allowed the second time to perform CPR. And so he died. And the nurse was saying, wait a minute, we just performed CPR on this man. Like, why not send in the same team to do it again, to revive him and to bring him back? But they were told no, under no circumstances were they to revive him again. And the man died.
Kristen Jordan Seamus writes for the Detroit Free Press, and she's been covering the case of four nurses who filed suit against Tenet Healthcare. Kristen, thanks for the update, and we're looking forward to reading more coverage on the case.
Thanks so much. Take care.
Next on the show, we speak with author Sharon Harrigan about her latest novel, Half, a story of childhood trauma and unbreakable family ties set right here in Michigan. That's after the break. Stick around. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Sharon Harrigan's new novel, entitled Half, is a story about twins coming of age in an abusive family set in Michigan. It tracks the two sisters' almost mystical connection and how their bond breaks down under the pressure of their father's antagonism and the mystery surrounding their family's story. The book was chosen as a first runner-up for the AWP Novel Prize. Sharon Harrigan grew up in Michigan and now lives in Virginia. She previously published a memoir called Playing with Dynamite. Sharon Harrigan, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So your protagonists are twins, Artis and Paula, named approximately for the divine Greek twins, Artemis and Apollo, the Greek gods who were also twins. And they had this really complicated relationship with their father, who was very hard on them, abusive, really, both physically and psychologically. You're not a twin, are you?
No, I'm not.
Okay. How did you settle on twins?
Yeah, it was a process. I didn't start out thinking I was going to write about twins. I started out thinking I wanted to write about a close relationship, about intimacy and about empathy. And I was very close to my brother when I was growing up. We were a year and a half apart. And it seemed normal back then, but now it seems kind of magical. And so I started writing about siblings because they share biology, they share environment. It seems like for a platonic relationship, they have the possibility to have the closest bond. So I wrote at first I wrote about this girl and a boy who are brother and sister. But then as I took the idea of intimacy further and further, so that they actually became almost indistinguishable, and people at least thought they were, couldn't tell them apart, I realized that I had to actually make them both girls, and then further than that, make them twins. So I took this thing from my life and exaggerated it, hoping that would make the idea clearer.
I think a lot of people wish for a twin in wishing for someone who understands them completely. And yet I know a lot, there are twins who don't get along.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like these two do. Would you read from the beginning of the book for us?
Sure. The beginning of chapter one. We wanted to crawl back in time. Even then, we were only five, but that wasn't young enough. The more we played this game, hovering outside our parents' door after dinner, trying to hear their mysterious bedroom sounds while pretending we didn't, the more we wanted to be babies again, or even to slip back into our mother's belly, the way we slid into her bed those nights when Dad was away on a hunting trip. "I'm 2 years old," we said. "How old are you?" "I'm 2". At first, we had been alive 6 months, just 1/2 year. Later, 1/2 no longer stood for anything, 1/2 empty, 1/2 full. We babbled and baby talked the way our own children do now when they don't want us to understand. Our friend Nevaeh had a baby brother, and he was always sucking at his mother's breast. So we knew milk was food. Milk was love.
Like a lot of twins, Artis and Paula have a great deal that passes between them that other people don't understand. You said you wanted to explore intimacy. What appeals to you about having that kind of narration about a shared understanding?
Well, it's kind of a metaphor made literal of people feeling so close that they can read each other's minds, like a married couple who are so close they can finish each other's sentences. And I take that idea and actually say, yes, I'm going to make it a literal thing. What I love about my first book was memoir, so I was really stuck with having to stay with the facts. And what I love about fiction is the ability to take something that maybe can start with the literal truth and stretch it so that it can even become kind of magical. And you can see that idea, I think, in a new way. The point of view is kind of magical. It's not possible for two people to speak as one, to think as one. And so I get to explore this idea through fiction, which allows us to go beyond the literal truth.
The book narrates their family life from a very early age, and it feels like the twins are on to the fact that their dad is pretty awful very early in their lives. Do you think that that kind of literal understanding is, do you observe that that's the case for kids suffering from abuse?
So I didn't suffer from abuse as a child, but I had a traumatic experience, which is that my father died when I was 7. I think that's part of what made my brother and me so close, is that we were trying to survive this traumatic experience together and feeling like kind of no one knew what was going on and we couldn't put it into words. But when we were with each other, we didn't have to put it into words. We just kind of were together. And that almost felt like reading each other's thoughts. And so I do, because I had this traumatic event happen to me at such a young age, I have very vivid memories of what it feels like to be that young and how I just didn't understand anything. Like, what was magic? What was real? What was death? You know, were our parents gods? Would they live forever? And I kind of promised myself that I would remember what that felt like to be a kid. And now, you know, I have kids myself. I'm fascinated to see how they really are living in a different kind of world and having different experiences than adults do.
A lot of the grist of the book is following Artis and Paula from their childhood and this very vivid experience they're having of joy and fear into their adult lives. What interested you in talking about that transition growing from childhood and a very difficult childhood into adulthood? What did you have to figure out how to say?
Well, another thing that I think fiction does so well is show the characters changing, their personal growth, their epiphanies, how they can analyze events and see them differently. They change. That's the arc of a novel. I set it up so that you sort of see the narrators, the twins' lives happening in real time. There's one chapter for every year from ages 5 to 22 as they are looking through their childhood themselves, their 30-year-olds, at their father's funeral, trying to understand exactly what happened in their childhood and who's to blame for this sort of murder mystery. So I liked having the reader get to see as they remember and they come to different conclusions. So, you know, they had kind of these set ideas of what happened in their lives. But then as they analyze them retrospectively, they actually come up with different ideas. And I think it's so easy for us to keep these ideas of what happened in our lives, to have these memories be things that never change, that we never question. So in fiction, it's an opportunity to have my characters question what happened and question their memories and grow and change and have a bigger understanding than they had before. Mm-hmm. And I hope readers will be inspired to think to do the same thing in their own life.
Do you mind talking about the point at which you were sort of going through that, I guess, interrogation process of your own experience?
So my father died when I was 7. We didn't really talk about it much, and I never really understood what happened. But then there was this moment when my daughter turned 8 at her 8th birthday party, when I was thinking that my father never got to see me turn 8. And I wrote a blog post about it, and that kind of snowballed into my brother responding, my mother responding, and everybody in my family sort of starting to talk about this again and telling me stories. And then I started to investigate, well, so what actually did happen? How did he die? How did he blow off his right arm playing with dynamite? What does playing with dynamite mean? So it was really kind of having my own kids that made me look back at what it was like when I was a kid.
And it seems like you discovered through that process that kind of everybody needed to talk about it.
Yes, I thought it was taboo that I was not supposed to talk about. What I found out was that my mother was waiting for me to show signs that I was ready to talk about it.
Can I ask you to read from a little later segment of the book?
Yeah, at this point, they are 30 years old. They have 5-year-old children themselves. The book begins when they are 5. Now they have their own 5-year-olds. And they are both living far away from Michigan. One of them is a singer in New York City, and one of them is in the Army. It started with the call that came the same time every year, "Come home." We could almost hear Mom lean into the palm that held her cell, almost see her other hand twisting a ringlet that had fallen from her bun, legs jiggling with enough nervous energy to light a window display. "Please come see your family for Christmas." We wanted to make her happy, but we didn't want to see Dad. So we said, "Not this time, maybe next year." Our throats burned with the rawness of our lies. Mom told our sons that Michigan was the land of perpetual snow, so they begged us to take them there. She didn't admit that these snowstorms were monstrous. 10 years had passed since our meteorology professor said they would be. Not every place had warmed. In Michigan, the weather just became weirder. "The state is even shaped like a giant mitten," Mom said. The boys spun around and around, littering the floor with shredded paper, shouting, "White Christmas!" Then we texted each other, "Wish we could take the boys to Michigan." We could, if Dad was gone.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Sharon Harrigan. She's reading to us from her new novel. It's called Half.
And this is also, to be clear, the novel is set 10 years in the future, so in 2030. And by this time, the snow has become kind of mythically weirder and weirder. I'm kind of foreseeing some climate change that is a little bit exaggerated, but has a grain in what might happen.
So there's some speculative fiction there, too.
Yes, yes.
Right. So when you get to this point of Artis and Paula trying to figure out, you know, who their father really was, what was his deal, and why did their mother stay with him for as long as she did, and what were her reasons for not, I guess, protecting them a little bit better? I mean, those are some pretty painful places to take your characters.
Yeah, I think they go to some deep emotional places. I hope that in the end it feels cathartic to readers to go to those deep places and come out the other end.
If we could just switch gears for a minute. You grew up, as we said, in Michigan, but you're living in Charlottesville, Virginia right now. Was there anything particular to Michigan that you wanted in this book?
I mean, you know, Michigan is my heart. So I grew up in the Detroit area, southwest, downriver in Lincoln Park. But my grandparents came from northern Michigan, Kalkaska, and they still had an unfinished house that we would spend time there in the summer. And my father spent a lot of time in northern Michigan hunting and in the woods, and was very much his soul. He was in the city, you know, because of work, but it was the country in northern Michigan that was really his soul. And so it's my soul too. And I feel so connected to this place.
This is the kind of conversation that I think a lot of people who've grown up in the Midwest and then leave may have at some point, or who, you know, if people have children who've grown up in the Midwest and leave, they have that conversation with their kids. although it means some different things for artists and Paula than it does for just about everybody. Have you had that conversation yourself? You know, parents longing to see children who sometimes have had really valid reasons for trying to get away.
Yes, I think that is something that I think it's painful probably for the parents whose children don't come home as much as they wish they did. And frankly, I'm sure that I have not always come home as much as most of my cousins, most of my family is still in Michigan. And so I think my parents would be happy if I was closer by and came home more often.
What did you want to show about how the twins had to figure out their own relationship with where they were from, with their need to?
Because it is who they are. It's their identity. And also, you know, their father names them after these Greek gods because he wants them to feel like this is their fate, that they should become these kind of heroic figures, these larger-than-life people. And they kind of fight against that. He teaches them how to play guitar by ear when they're five, and he teaches them all these physical stuff that he learned in the army. And so he kind of passes on to them all the powers that he has, and they fight against that. But in the end, they actually realize that they are what he thought they would be. They kind of do fulfill their fate. They are kind of where they came from and who they came from. That is who they are. That's their identity. And they feel that pull that they can't escape it.
I just wanted to ask a thing or two about the place where you're living right now, Charlottesville, Virginia. Charlottesville has been touched, I guess, as much as any American city by the issues that have been raised by Black Lives Matter. And it was the place where a 2017 white supremacist rally ended with the killing of one person who was a counter-protester. It was a really intense moment, and it helped to set the stage for some of the protests, I think, in the country right now. I just wondered what things are like in Charlottesville at this moment.
Yeah, that's a really good question because, of course, we can't forget what happened on August 12th. It's an interesting time to be in Virginia. Just the other day, my husband and I went to Richmond, which of course was the capital of the Confederacy. And Monument Avenue is where the monuments for all the Confederate generals are. And now that we have a legislature that is going to allow the localities in Virginia to remove their monuments, it is going to happen. It hasn't quite happened yet, but what has happened is that there's been this public defacement, and all the monuments have spray painted Black Lives Matter all over them. And when we were there on Saturday, there were people giving speeches, there were marches, there were food trucks, there was music. And what's kind of amazing is it's change is happening. And so people are actually, the mood I think was very, very somber at first after the death of George Floyd. And still there's a lot of grief, but there is a sense here, I think, that that's the catalyst. George Floyd's cousin was there speaking. Things actually are now starting to change, and there's a little bit of feeling of hope.
When you think about how growing up in Michigan has shaped how you move through this world, what comes to mind?
Well, being up north with my grandparents, that was just a magical time where we would go in walks in the woods, and they had these pipelines that were now covered with blackberry vines, and we would put out salt for the deer. And so to me, it's just this beautiful place of wildness. And then I think Detroit is like one of the most fascinating places in America. Of course, now, you know, with what's happening with Black Lives Matter, you know, there's been a lot happening in historically in Detroit related to race relations too. There's a lot that's hopeful.
Well, Sharon Harrigan, thank you so much for the book. It's really lovely. And thanks for talking to us about it.
Oh, thank you so much. I loved your questions. Thank you for reading.
Author Sharon Harrigan. Her new novel is called Half. She has an online author event Wednesday night presented by Literati Books in Ann Arbor. If you're interested in connecting, just check the Literati webpage. Arts and culture coverage on Stateside is supported in part by an award from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. We're always glad to hear your takes, whether it's the post-COVID economy, protests, what's happening to kids or seniors during the pandemic, or anything else that's on your mind. Send us an email. The address is stateside@michiganradio.org. You can leave comments on the Michigan Radio Facebook page. Or hit us on Twitter. Our handle is Stateside Radio. Up next, the call to defund the police is resonating across the country. We'll dig into what that might mean and explore a new model of public safety and policing.
Why can't city leaders and police sit down and come up with viable solutions from city leaders, from residents, and find out how we can allocate some of that $54 million back in the community for trauma, back in the community for education, back in the community for job opportunities.
Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. If you've followed the protests sweeping Michigan cities and the rest of the United States, no doubt you've heard people saying defund the police. It's also been scrawled across poster boards and chanted by protesters. In Grand Rapids, some community members are calling for the city to reopen the budget, which was finalized in May, and put that money to use in other ways. We wanted to hear more about what's meant by defund the police. Joining us today is LaDonna Norman. She's a community activist with the Grand Rapids group, Together We Are Safe. And her group is part of a coalition that has come together to work on this issue. LaDonna, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for having me.
Can you describe what the relationship between residents and Black residents, especially in Grand Rapids and the police department, feels like right now?
I can tell you from experience and observation that there's uncertainty and there's a disconnect with the Grand Rapids Police Department and the Black community. There's no people put in place for us to repair those relations.
Yeah. Well, we should say there's some history here in terms of, you know, the people, you know, I think a lot of people who don't live in Grand Rapids maybe know about the fact that there have been protests recently over the deaths of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and Ahmaud Arbery, but that there's also a history with the local police department, especially in recent years, with how young Black people have been treated by the police. Can you maybe just tell us a little bit about what the protests looked and felt like with the knowledge of all those different events informing people's feelings about this?
So I could tell you that a group of people walked from a local inner city park downtown in solidarity with Black Lives Matter. And when we got there, it wasn't very welcoming. There was about 50 to 75 people out there, give or take, maybe even 100 at the most. And they were just sitting around, but we had come down there with the intent to say, our voices matter, our voices need to be heard. And we didn't think that our voices could be heard at Rosa Parks. Grand Rapids downtown is not for Black people or poor people. So it didn't seem fitting that we would be in a place where we're not even welcomed. I thought that we should start right where we live and come down there. But I can tell you that maybe after an hour and a half of chanting and, you know, letting our voices be heard. And there were different people just taking our megaphone and out there just saying whatever they felt they needed to say to represent us as a culture and as a people and as a community. And something happened within an hour and a half of that protest. This is the middle of the day. There were people that came from every single direction. I'm talking about, they were shutting down streets. They were coming in cars. They were coming in pickup trucks. They were coming on bikes and motorcycles. From my observation, it almost seemed staged.
Do you mean that the police response felt staged to you or prepared?
I felt prepared in that the people, the way they rushed in, it reminded me of something that was staged. When I was downtown, there was literally 100 people. And I blinked and it was 1,000, like it was a movie. The drones that started appearing from nowhere, the police were in the corner, and I was sprayed with a chemical and I passed out. And I went to the doctor and I was diagnosed with a chemical induced breathing problem. I was having to take breathing treatments every 4 to 6 hours. The reason I sound like a frog right now is because I'm still recovering from what they did.
Was it tear gas, do you know?
Whatever it was, there were so many people that came all at once, you wouldn't have seen it or noticed it. That's why it didn't look real to me.
LaDonna, your group has been working with several other organizations within the community. Movimiento Cosecha, GR, Grand Rapid Response to ICE, and the 360 GR movement, to talk about a whole platform of reforms that you're saying that the city needs to talk about immediately. And part of it does have to do with defunding the police. Could you tell us about what that phrase means to you?
So police reforms have not really made a difference in the safety of Black people, which is why we're calling for the defunding of the police, the Grand Rapids Police Department. We want to also call for the redirecting of the current GRPD budget. It was $54 million in 2019. That should go towards people affected by police violence. And those affected most are Black and Brown people.
Mm-hmm.
Black and Brown communities should be able to make decisions on how that $54 million should have been spent. We want to actually promote a community of care, which would result in real safety. We believe that if people have their needs met, that crime would be reduced and we could take care of our own communities. So what I'm seeing and what the community needs is we need that money to go back in the community and address the problems that have been done by the police, the abuse. We have trauma. What things are in place for trauma for Black and Brown people? It's not. There's just more police.
Right now, the city charter has language in it that says that the police department has to receive the equivalent of at least 32% of the general fund budget. Have the groups in the coalition had any conversations either amongst yourselves or with folks on city council about how to deal with the fact that this is so ingrained in the city's budget process that it's even in the charter?
I'm just why is all that money needed for a city that made the Forbes list?
Mm-hmm.
And there are different groups that we've emailed the mayor, we've sent emails out, mass emails out about defunding the police, and formed relationships with others that are in solidarity with defunding the police, because these funds could go back into the community. They should be allocated for the community. There's so many people attached to this and so many people that have one common goal, and that is to repair and rebuild the Black and Brown communities.
If you're just joining us, my guest is LaDonna Norman. She's an activist with the group Together We Are Safe in Grand Rapids. We've had conversations even with at least one sheriff, not from the Grand Rapids area, but from elsewhere, who, you know, when asked about the idea of defunding, said, well, he actually even said he hoped that that can happen someday, but that as things stand, it's not possible to defund. How do you respond to people who say that defunding is not practical?
How do I respond? Why isn't it? It's really easy for folks that are not directly affected to have that type of attitude. But where I come from, people that look like me, they, from a very early age, they have interactions with the police and they're not the best. So most of the people that are yelling that are people that have never been directly affected the way Black and Brown communities have. So how can you speak on something that you have no direct connection to? There is a cause and effect. And what did they think? That they were going to be able to do this and things were going to get better? Because the only time the police involves themselves in the Black community is when violence happens. Why does violence have to occur to have communication with the police? Why can't it be positive interaction? Why can't city leaders and police sit down and come up with viable solutions from city leaders, from residents, and find out how we can allocate some of that $54 million back in the community for trauma, back in the community for education, back in the community for job opportunities, back in the community to take care of the community? I've found that if you take care of the community, community will take care of it.
In recent years, a number of cities, including Grand Rapids, have put into effect some reforms for policing. Things like anti-bias training, or in Grand Rapids, there are specific rules about interacting with children. Do you think that these kinds of reforms have made any difference in terms of the trust that the community has in its police?
I mean, how can you put policies in place when you have police that can't distinguish a 12-year-old from a 25-year-old or a 40-year-old? The language sounds good when you put it on paper, but how can you put policies in place when it's clearly a difference in the way African-American girls and boys, women and men develop? Our appearance is already threatening from a very young age. They keep making these mistakes and putting these policies in place, and we keep repeating ourselves. So when does it end? Why is this a continued cycle? Why does it work in some areas where they have three or four police and not in other areas? You can't keep saying the same thing and expecting us to be comfortable with the same results.
To a lot of people, this moment feels a little different than protests that happened, you know, after the death of Michael Brown or any number of other men and women who were killed by police use of force. Do you think that there's enough political momentum this time to get city leaders to actually sign on to the changes you're pushing for?
That would be a question for city leaders.
Have you spoken with any of them?
They're not going to speak with me. Everything's virtual due to COVID. Mm-hmm. I mean, if we were in city chambers having real interaction, person-to-person interaction, which we're unable to do. I mean, things are just so different now. I don't even know how to answer that question.
You're saying the process is not conducive to even having a formal conversation with the city about this right now.
I just think that when we go to the city, they're going to give you controlled responses like they're paid to do. And they're able to write something out and put it in a language that sounds great, but nobody is enforcing it. So why have a policy? Who enforces the enforcers?
So no one has reached out to Together We Are Safe?
I'm pretty sure that we all got the same email.
Was it from the city?
It was from the mayor. Let's see what the email. See if I can pull that email up. So this is from the mayor's office on June 9th. Good afternoon. Thank you for your email to Mayor's Bliss office. We appreciate your engagement, as the mayor does appreciate hearing your thoughts and recommendations. As you can likely imagine, we are hearing from hundreds of people throughout the community on ways to move forward and how best to implement police reform and eliminate systemic racism. I assure you that the mayor is committed to closely examining each idea and recommendation and then moving forward with meaningful action. Thank you again for sharing your thoughts with our office, as we need everyone in the community engaging in this important work.
Yeah.
Laura Olson, this is a controlled response.
Mm-hmm.
This is supposed to make me feel better about what the mayor is going to do next. And the mayor is going to do what the mayor does best. The mayor is going to give another controlled response. And we're going to sit and hold our breath, and things aren't going to change.
I think I can guess the answer to this next question based on what you told me before, but we were curious to know about the police department's response. We did invite the chief to come on air, and a representative said, quoting here, "Understandably, the chief is very busy focusing on doing the work that needs to be addressed and is therefore unable to grant every request for media interviews." Regardless of how communicative the GRPD is with the media, has your group had any conversations with the police?
I actually had a conversation with the chief the day after the riot, because on the Sunday, I wanted to get downtown very early and assess the damage. And what was hard to understand was, if this riot lasted till 4:30 a.m., and here I am at 6:30 a.m. downtown, how did they find out about the cleanup? You followed the riot all night, and then you were gung-ho on getting downtown volunteering to clean up? It just all looked staged to me. I talked to the chief of police. He told me to have a good day. I then in turn said, "Wow, you're brushing me off, but when we're at the city commission meeting, you want to be all up in my face. Don't come to me when it's convenient or when the cameras are rolling. Come to me when you really want to do something with and for the community." I think the chief doesn't have our best interest. I think when they pick the chief, they pick the person who is able to turn a blind eye to Black and Brown communities.
LaDonna Norman is an activist with the Grand Rapids group Together We Are Safe, a part of a coalition that has been asking the city to reconsider funding for the police. LaDonna, thank you for your time. We really appreciate your being willing to come on and talk with us.
Thank you for having me.
Just to restate, we did make multiple requests to the Grand Rapids Police Department to see if the chief would be able to talk to us about these requests. And again, part of the response says, "We'll pass on your invitation and get our message out in the many other ways that are available to us." Quick note for you about tomorrow's show. Michigan Radio has been working on a new podcast series. It was supposed to be about mental health among teenagers, closely following a cohort of Michigan high schoolers. Well, things happened. Pandemic, lockdown, so much more than most young people have had to deal with in their lives. It seems that the weird changes in school and social life have made an even thicker stew for us to talk about. Please join us tomorrow on the show as we bring you sounds from kids these days. It's an unfiltered look at teenage life, what they're talking about, laughing about, and stressing about.
Adults think they know us. We're always on our phones, we have zero attention span, we're not prepared for the real world. Maybe that's part of the story, but there's so much more to all of us than that. You really want to know what we're thinking about, laughing about, and stressing about? Listen to Kids These Days, a new podcast from Community High School and Michigan Radio, coming June 17th.
That's our show for today. I'm April Bear. Thank you for listening. Until tomorrow.